seen, but her teeth are black, and children torn in two in widow hands, which rolling, rolling halves of children, roll them into little balls. The balls are green, the night is black, and little balls fly into night. Between the walls the children shriek, as one by one the widow's hand. And in a corner the monkey and I, the walls are green, the shadows black, cowering, crawling, wide high walls, green, fading into black. There is no roof, and widow's hand comes one by one, the children screaming, and little balls and hand, and screaming, and splashing stains of black. Now only she and I, and no more screams. The widow's hand comes hunting, hunting. The skin is green, the nails are black, towards the corner, hunting, hunting. While we shrink closer into the corner, our skin is green, our fear is black. And now the hand comes reaching, reaching, and she, my sister, pushes me out of the corner, while she stays cowering, staring. The hand, the nails are curling, screaming, and splash of black, and up into the high, a sky, and laughing widow tearing. I am rolling into little balls, the balls are green, and out into the night is black. The fever broke today. For 2 days, I'm told, Padma has been sitting up all night, placing cold, wet flannels on my forehead, holding me through my shivers and dreams of widow's hands. For 2 days she has been blaming herself for her potion of unknown herbs. But, I reassure her, this time it wasn't anything to do with that. I recognize this fever. It's come up from inside me and from nowhere else. Like a bad stink, it's oozed through my cracks. I caught exactly such a fever on my 10th birthday and spent 2 days in bed. Now, as my memories return to leak out of me, this old fever has come back too. Don't worry, I say. I caught these germs almost 21 years ago. We are not alone. It is morning at the pickle factory. They have brought my son to see me. Someone, never mind who, stands beside Padma at my bedside, holding him in her arms.
"Baba, thank God you are better. You don't know what you were talking in your sickness,"
someone speaks anxiously, trying to force her way into my story ahead of time. But it won't work. Someone who founded this pickle factory and its ancillary bottling works, who has been looking after my impenetrable child just as once. Wait on. She nearly wormed it out of me then. But fortunately, I've still got my wits about me, fever or no fever. Someone will just have to step back and remain cloaked in anonymity until it's her turn. And that won't be until the very end. I turn my eyes away from her to look at Padma. Do not think, I admonish her, that because I had a fever, the things I told you were not completely true. Everything happened just as I described.
Oh, God, you and your stories, she cries. All day, all night, you have made yourself sick. Stop sometime, huh? What will it hurt?
I set my lips obstinately. And now she, with a sudden change of mood,
so tell me now, mister, is there anything you want?
Green chutney, I request, bright green, green as grasshoppers. And someone who cannot be named remembers and tells Padma, speaking in the soft voice, which is only used at sickbeds and funerals, I know what he means.
Why, at this crucial instant, when all manner of things were waiting to be described, when the Pioneer Cafe was so close and the rivalry of knees and nose, did I introduce a mere condiment into the conversation? Why do I waste time in this account on a humble preserve when I could be describing the elections of 1957, when all India is waiting 21 years ago to vote?
Because I sniffed the air and scented behind the solicitous expressions of my visitors a sharp whiff of danger. I intended to defend myself, but I required the assistance of chutney. I have not shown you the factory in daylight until now. That is what has remained undescribed. Through green-tinged glass windows, my room looks out onto an iron catwalk, and then down to the cooking floor, where copper vats bubble and seethe, where strong-armed women stand atop wooden steps, working long-handled ladles through the knife-tang of pickle fumes, while, looking the other way, through a green-tinged window on the world, railway tracks shine dully in morning sun, bridged over at regular intervals by the messy gantries of the electrification system. In daylight, our saffron and green neon goddess does not dance above the factory doors.
We switch her off to save power. But electric trains are using power. Yellow and brown local trains clatter south towards Churchgate Station from Dada and Sorevili, from Kurla and Basian Road. Human flies hang in thick white-trousered clusters from the trains. I do not deny that within the factory walls you may also see some flies, but there are also compensating lizards hanging stilly upside down on the ceiling, their jowls reminiscent of the Kathiawar Peninsula. Sounds, too, have been waiting to be heard. Bubbling of vats, loud singing, coarse imprecations, bawdy humour of fuzz-armed women, the sharp-nosed, thin-lipped admonitions of overseers, the all-pervasive clank of pickle jars from the adjacent bottling works, and rush of trains and the buzzing, infrequent but inevitable, of flies. While grasshopper green chutney is being extracted from its vat to be brought on a wiped clean plate with saffron and green stripes around the rim, along with another plate piled high with snacks from the local Irani shop, while what has now been shown goes on as usual and what can now be heard fills the air, to say nothing of what can be smelled. I, alone in bed in my office, realise with a start of alarm that outings are being suggested. When you are stronger, someone who cannot be named is saying, a day at Elephanta, why not? A nice ride in a motor launch, and all those caves with so beautiful carvings, or Juhu Beach for swimming and coconut milk and camel races, or Are Milk Colony even. And Padma, fresh air, yes, and the little one will like to be with his father. And someone patting my son on his head, there, of course, we will all go. Nice picnic, nice day out, Baba. It will do you good. As chutney arrives, bearer born in my room, I hasten to put a stop to these suggestions. No, I refuse. I have work to do. And I see a look pass between Padma and someone, and I see that I've been right to be suspicious, because I've been tricked by offers of picnics once before. Once before, false smiles and offers of Are Milk Colony have fooled me into going out of doors and into a motor car. And then, before I knew it, there were hands seizing me. There were hospital corridors and doctors and nurses holding me in place, while over my nose a mask poured anaesthetic over me, and a voice said, "Count now, count to 10." I know what they are planning. Listen, I tell them, I don't need doctors. And Padma, doctors? Who is talking about? But she is fooling nobody. And with a little smile I say, here, everybody, take some chutney. I must tell you some important things. And while chutney, the same chutney which, back in 1957, my ayah, Mary Pereira, had made so perfectly, the grasshopper green chutney, which is forever associated with those days, carried them back into the world of my past, while chutney mellowed them and made them receptive. I spoke to them, gently, persuasively, and by a mixture of condiment and oratory, kept myself out of the hands of the pernicious green medicine men. I said, my son will understand, as much as for any living being, I am telling my story for him, so that afterwards, when I've lost my struggle against cracks, he will know. Morality, judgment, character, it all starts with memory, and I am keeping carbons. Green chutney on chili pakoras disappearing down someone's gullet, grasshopper green on tepid chapatis, vanishing behind Padma's lips. I see them begin to weaken and press on. I told you the truth, I say yet again. Memory's truth, because memory has its own special kind. It selects, eliminates, alters, exaggerates, minimizes, glorifies, and vilifies also. But in the end, it creates its own reality, its heterogeneous but usually coherent version of events. And no sane human being ever trusts someone else's version more than his own. Yes, I said. Sane. I knew what they were thinking. Plenty of children invent imaginary friends, but 1,001? That's just crazy. The midnight children shook even Padma's faith in my narrative. But I brought her round, and now there is no more talk of outings. How I persuaded them? By talking about my son, who needed to know my story, by shedding light on the workings of memory, and by other devices, some naively honest, others wily as foxes. Even Muhammad, I said, at first believed himself insane. Do you think the notion never crossed my mind? But the Prophet had his Khadija, his Abu Bakr, to reassure him of the genuineness of his calling. Nobody betrayed him into the hands of asylum doctors. By now, the green chutney was filling them with thoughts of years ago. I saw guilt appear on their faces and shame. What is truth? I waxed rhetorical. What is sanity? Did Jesus rise up from the grave? Do Hindus not accept, Padma, that the world is a kind of dream, that Brahma dreamed, is dreaming the universe? That we only see dimly through that dream web, which is Maya. Maya, I adopted a haughty lecturing tone, may be defined as all that is illusory, as trickery, artifice, and deceit. Apparitions, phantasms, mirages, sleight of hand, the seeming form of things, all these are parts of Maya. If I say that certain things took place which you, lost in Brahma's dream, find hard to believe, then which of us is right? Have some more chutney, I added graciously, taking a generous helping myself. It tastes very good. Padma began to cry. I never said I didn't believe, she wept. Of course, every man must tell his story in his own true way, but, I interrupted conclusively, you also, don't you, want to know what happens? About the hands that dance without touching, and the knees, and later the curious baton of Commander Sabarmati, and of course, the widow? And the children. What became of them? And Padma nodded. So much for doctors and asylums. I have been left to write. Alone, except for Padma at my feet. Chutney and oratory, theology and curiosity. These are the things that save me. And one more. Call it education or class origins. Mary Pereira would have called it my brought up. By my show of erudition and by the purity of my accents, I shame them into feeling unworthy of judging me. Not a very noble deed, but when the ambulance is waiting round the corner, all's fair. It was. I smelled it. Still, I've had a valuable warning. It's a dangerous business to try and impose one's view of things on others. Padma, if you're a little uncertain of my reliability, well, a little uncertainty is no bad thing. Cocksure men do terrible deeds. Women, too. Meanwhile, I am 10 years old and working out how to hide in the boot of my mother's car. That was the month when Purushottam the sadhu, whom I had never told about my inner life, finally despaired of his stationary existence and contracted the suicidal hiccups which assailed him for an entire year, frequently lifting him bodily several inches off the ground so that his water-balded head cracked alarmingly against the garden tap and finally killed him. So that one evening, at the cocktail hour, he toppled sideways with his legs still locked in the lotus position, leaving my mother's verrucas without any hope of salvation. When I would often stand in the garden of Buckingham Villa in the evenings, watching the Sputniks cross the sky, and feeling as simultaneously exalted and isolated as little Laika, the first and still the only dog to be shot into space, the Baroness Simke von der Heiden, shortly to contract syphilis, sat beside me following the bright pinprick of Sputnik 2 with her Alsatian eyes. It was a time of great canine interest in the space race, when Evie Burns and her gang occupied my clock tower, and washing chests had been both forbidden and outgrown, so that for the sake of secrecy and sanity, I was obliged to limit my visits to the midnight children to our private silent hour. I communed with them every midnight, and only at midnight, during that hour which is reserved for miracles, which is somehow outside time. And when, to get to the point, I resolved to prove, with the evidence of my own eyes, the terrible thing I had glimpsed sitting in the front of my mother's thoughts. Ever since I lay hidden in a washing chest and heard two scandalous syllables, I had been suspecting my mother of secrets. My incursions into her thought processes confirmed my suspicions. So it was, with a hard glint in my eye and a steely determination, that I visited Sonny Ibrahim one afternoon after school with the intention of enlisting his help. I found Sonny in his room, surrounded by posters of Spanish bullfights, morosely playing indoor cricket by himself. When he saw me, he cried unhappily, "Hey, man, I'm damn sorry about Evie, man. She won't listen to anyone, man. What the hell do you do to her anyway?" But I held up a dignified hand, commanding and being accorded silence. "No time for that now, man," I said. "The thing is, I need to know how to open locks without keys." A true fact about Sonny Ibrahim. Despite all his bullfighting dreams, his genius lay in the realm of mechanical things. For some time now, he had taken on the job of maintaining all the bikes on Methil's estate in return for gifts of comic books and a free supply of fizzy drinks. Even Evelyn Lilith Burns gave her beloved India bike into his care. All machines, it seemed, were won over by the innocent delight with which he caressed their moving parts. No contraption could resist his ministrations. To put it another way, Sonny Ibrahim had become, out of a spirit of pure inquiry, an expert at picking locks. Now, offered a chance of demonstrating his loyalty to me, his eyes brightened. "Just show me the lock, man. Lead me to the thing." When we were sure we were unobserved, we crept along the driveway between Buckingham Villa and Sonny's Sans Souci. We stood behind my family's old Rover, and I pointed at the boot. "That's the one," I stated. "I need to be able to open it from the outside and the inside also." Sonny's eye widened. "Hey, what are you up to, man? You running away from home secretly and all?" Finger to lips, I adopted a mysterious expression. "Can't explain, Sonny," I said solemnly. "Top drawer, classified information." "Wow, man," Sonny said, and showed me in 30 seconds how to open the boot with the aid of a strip of thin pink plastic. "Take it, man," said Sonny Ibrahim. "You need it more than me." Once upon a time there was a mother who, in order to become a mother, had agreed to change her name, who set herself the task of falling in love with her husband bit by bit, but who could never manage to love one part, the part curious enough which made possible her motherhood, whose feet were hobbled by verrucas and whose shoulders were stooped beneath the accumulating guilts of the world, whose husband's unlovable organ failed to recover from the effects of a freeze, and who, like her husband, finally succumbed to the mysteries of telephones, spending long minutes listening to the words of wrong number callers. Shortly after my 10th birthday, when I had recovered from the fever which has recently returned to plague me after an interval of nearly 21 years, Amina Sinai resumed her recent practice of leaving suddenly and always immediately after a wrong number on urgent shopping trips. But now, hidden in the boot of the Rover, there travelled with her a stowaway who lay hidden and protected by stolen cushions, clutching a thin strip of pink plastic in his hand. Oh, the suffering one undergoes in the name of righteousness! The bruising and the bumps, the breathing in of rubbery boot air through jolted teeth, and constantly the fear of discovery. Suppose she really does go shopping? Will the boot suddenly fly open? Will live chickens be flung in, feet tied together, wings clipped, fluttery pecky birds invading my hidey-hole? Will she see? My God, I'll have to be silent for a week! My knees, drawn in beneath my chin, which was protected against knee bumps by an old faded cushion, I voyaged into the unknown in the vehicle of maternal perfidy. My mother was a cautious driver. She went slowly and turned corners with care. But afterwards I was bruised black and blue, and Mary Pereira berated me soundly for getting into fights. "Hey, God, what a thing! It's a wonder they didn't smash you to pieces completely. My God! What will you grow up into, you bad black boy, you huddy failwan, you skin-and-bone wrestler?" To take my mind off the jolting darkness, I entered with extreme caution that part of my mother's mind which was in charge of driving operations, and as a result was able to follow our route, and also to discern in my mother's habitually tidy mind an alarming degree of disorder. I was already beginning in those days to classify people by their degree of internal tidiness, and to discover that I preferred the messier type, whose thoughts spinning constantly into one another, so that anticipatory images of food interfered with the serious business of earning a living, and sexual fantasies were superimposed upon their political musings, bore a closer relationship to my own pell-mell tumble of a brain, in which everything ran into everything else, and the white dot of consciousness jumped about like a wild flea from one thing to the next. Amina Sinai, whose assiduous ordering instincts had provided her with a brain of almost abnormal neatness, was a curious recruit to the ranks of confusion. We headed north, past Breach Candy Hospital and Mahalakshmi Temple, north along Hornby Vellard, past Valhallabhai Patel Stadium and Haji Ali's Island Tomb, north of what had once been, before the dream of the first William Methil became a reality, the island of Bombay. We were heading towards the anonymous mass of tenements and fishing villages and textile plants and film studios that the city became in these northern zones, not far from here, not at all far from where I sit within view of local trains, an area which was, in those days, utterly unknown to me. I rapidly became disoriented, and was then obliged to admit to myself that I was lost. At last, down an unprepossessing side street full of drainpipe sleepers and bicycle repair shops and tattered men and boys, we stopped. Clusters of children assailed my mother as she descended. She, who could never shoo away a fly, handed out small coins, thus enlarging the crowd enormously. Eventually, she struggled away from them and headed down the street. There was a boy pleading, "Gib de ka polis begum, number 1A class polis begum. I watch car until you come, begum. I very fine watchman. Ask anyone." In some panic, I listened in for her reply. How could I get out of this boot under the eyes of a guardian urchin? There was the embarrassment of it. And, besides, my emergence would have created a sensation in the street. My mother said no. She was disappearing down the street. The would-be polisher and watchman gave up eventually. There was a moment when all eyes turned to watch the passing of a second car, just in case it too stopped to disgorge a lady who gave away coins as if they were nuts. And in that instant, I had been looking through several pairs of eyes to help me choose my moment, I performed my trick with the pink plastic and was out in the street beside a closed car boot in a flash. Setting my lips grimly and ignoring all outstretched palms, I set off in the direction my mother had taken. A pocket-sized sleuth, with the nose of a bloodhound and a loud drum pounding in the place where my heart should have been, and arrived, a few minutes later, at the Pioneer Café. Dirty glass in the window. Dirty glasses on the tables. The Pioneer Café was not much when compared to the gaylords and qualities of the city's more glamorous parts. A rel ratputty joint, with painted boards proclaiming lovely lassi and funtabulous faluda and Belpuri Bombay fashion, with filmy playback music blaring out from a cheap radio by the cash till. A long, narrow, greeny room lit by flickering neon, a forbidding world in which broken-toothed men sat at resin-covered tables with crumpled cards and expressionless eyes. But for all its grimy decrepitude, the Pioneer Café was a repository of many dreams. Early each morning it would be full of the best-looking ne'er-do-wells in the city, all the gundas and taxi drivers and petty smugglers and racecourse tipsters who had once long ago arrived in the city dreaming of film stardom, of grotesquely vulgar homes and black money payments, because every morning at 6 the major studios would send minor functionaries to the Pioneer Café to rope in extras for the day's shooting. For half an hour each morning, when D.W. Rama Studios and Filmistan Talkies and RK Films were taking their pick, the Pioneer was the focus of all the city's ambitions and hopes. Then the studio scouts left, accompanied by the day's lucky ones, and the café emptied into its habitual neon-lit torpor. Around lunchtime, a different set of dreams walked into the café to spend the afternoon hunched over cards and lovely lassi and rough birris. Different men with different hopes. I didn't know it then, but the afternoon Pioneer was a notorious communist party hangout. It was afternoon. I saw my mother enter the Pioneer Café. Not daring to follow her, I stayed in the street, pressing my nose against a spider-web corner of the grubby window pane. ignoring the curious glances I got, because my whites, although boot-stained, were nevertheless starched. My hair, although boot-rumpled, was well-oiled. My shoes, scuffed as they were still the plimsolls of a prosperous child. I followed her with my eyes as she went hesitantly and Veruca-hobbled past rickety tables and hard-eyed men. I saw my mother sit down at a shadowed table at the far end of the narrow cavern, and then I saw the man who rose to greet her. The skin on his face hung in folds which revealed that he had once been overweight. His teeth were stained with paan. He wore a clean white kurtha with Lucknow work around the buttonholes. He had long hair, poetically long, hanging lankly over his ears, but the top of his head was bald and shiny. Forbidden syllables echoed in my ears. Nadir. Nadir. I realized that I wished desperately that I'd never resolved to come. Once upon a time, there was an underground husband who fled, leaving loving messages of divorce, a poet whose verses didn't even rhyme, whose life was saved by pie dogs. After a lost decade, he emerged from goodness knows where, his skin hanging loose in memory of his erstwhile plumpness, and, like his once-upon-a-time wife, he had acquired a new name. Nadir Khan was now Qasim Khan, official candidate of the official Communist Party of India. Lal Qasim, Qasim the Red. Nothing is without meaning. Not without reason are blushes red. My Uncle Hanif said, "Watch out for the communists!" And my mother turned scarlet. Politics and emotions were united in her cheeks. Through the dirty, square, glassy cinema screen of the Pioneer Cafe's window, I watched Amina Sanai and the no longer Nadir play out their love scene. They performed with the ineptitude of genuine amateurs. On the resin-top table, a packet of cigarettes, State Express 555. Numbers too have significance. 420, the name given to frauds. 1001, the number of night, of magic, of alternative realities. A number beloved of poets and detested by politicians, for whom all alternative versions of the world are threats. And 555, which for years I believed to be the most sinister of numbers, the cipher of the devil, the great beast, Shaitan himself. Cyrus the Great told me so, and I didn't contemplate the possibility of his being wrong. But he was. The true demonic number is not 555, but 666. Yet, in my mind, a dark aura hangs around the three fives to this day. But I'm getting carried away. Suffice to say that Nadir Qasim's preferred brand was the aforesaid State Express, that the figure 5 was repeated 3 times on the packet, and that its manufacturers were W.D. and H.O. Wills. Unable to look into my mother's face, I concentrated on the cigarette packet, cutting from 2 shot of lovers to this extreme close-up of nicotine. But now hands enter the frame. First, the hands of Nadir Qasim, their poetic softness somewhat callous these days, hands flickering like candle flames, creeping forward across resin, then jerking back, next a woman's hands, black as jet, inching forwards like elegant spiders, hands lifting up off resin tabletop, hands hovering above 3 fives, beginning the strangest of dances, rising, falling, circling one another, weaving in and out between each other, hands longing for touch, hands outstretching, tensing, quivering, demanding to be, but always, at last, jerking back, fingertips avoiding fingertips, because what I'm watching here on my dirty glass cinema screen is, after all, an Indian movie in which physical contact is forbidden, lest it corrupt the watching flower of Indian youth. And there are feet beneath the table and faces above it, feet advancing towards feet, faces tumbling softly towards faces, but jerking away all of a sudden in a cruel senses cut. 2 strangers, each bearing a screen name which is not the name of their birth, act out their half-unwanted roles. I left the movie before the end, to slip back into the boot of the unpolished, unwatched rover, wishing I hadn't gone to see it, unable to resist wanting to watch it all over again. What I saw at the very end, my mother's hands raising a half-empty glass of lovely lassie, my mother's lips pressing gently, nostalgically against the mottled glass, my mother's hands handing the glass to her Nadir Kazim, who also applied to the opposite side of the glass his own poetic mouth. So it was that life imitated bad art, and my Uncle Hanif's sister brought the eroticism of the indirect kiss into the green neon dinginess of the Pioneer Café. To sum up, in the high summer of 1957, at the peak of an election campaign, Amina Sanai blushed inexplicably at a chance mention of the Communist Party of India. Her son, in whose turbulent thoughts there was still room for one more obsession, because a 10-year-old brain can accommodate any number of fixations, followed her into the north of the city and spied on a pain-filled scene of impotent love. Now that Amit Sanai was frozen up, Nadir Kasim didn't even have a sexual disadvantage. Torn between a husband who locked himself in an office and cursed mongrels and an ex-husband who had once lovingly played games of hit the spittoon, Amina Sanai was reduced to glass kissery and hand dances. Questions. Did I ever, after that time, employ the services of Pink Plastic? Did I return to the cafe of extras and Marxists? Did I confront my mother with the heinous nature of her offence? Because what mother has any business to, never mind about what once upon a time, in full view of her only son? How could she? How could she? How could she? Answers. I did not. What I did. When she went on shopping trips, I lodged myself in her thoughts, no longer anxious to gain the evidence of my own eyes. I rode in my mother's head up to the north of the city in this unlikely incognito. I sat in the Pioneer Café and heard conversations about the electoral prospects of Qasim the Red, disembodied but wholly present. I trailed my mother as she accompanied Qasim on his rounds, up and down the tenements of the district. Were they the same chawls which my father had recently sold, abandoning his tenants to their fate? As she helped him to get water taps fixed and pestered landlords to initiate repairs and disinfections. Amina Sanai moved amongst the destitute on behalf of the Communist Party, a fact which never failed to leave her amazed. Perhaps she did it because of the growing impoverishment of her own life. But at the age of 10, I wasn't disposed to be sympathetic, and in my own way I began to dream dreams of revenge. The legendary Caliph Harun al-Rashid is said to have enjoyed moving incognito amongst the people of Baghdad. I, Salim Sanai, have also travelled in secret through the byways of my city. But I can't say I had much fun. Matter-of-fact descriptions of the outre and bazaar, and their reverse, namely heightened, stylized versions of the everyday. These techniques, which are also attitudes of mind, I have lifted, or perhaps absorbed, from the most formidable of the midnight children, my rival, my fellow changeling, the supposed son of Wee Willy Winky, Shiva of the Knees. They were techniques which, in his case, were applied entirely without conscious thought, and their effect was to create a picture of the world of startling uniformity, in which one could mention casually, in passing as it were, the dreadful murders of prostitutes which began to fill the gutter press in those days, while the bodies fill the gutters, while lingering passionately on the intricate details of a particular hand of cards. Death and defeat at Rummy were all of a piece to Shiva, hence his terrifying, nonchalant violence, which in the end... But to begin with beginnings. Although admittedly it's my own fault, I'm bound to say that if you think of me purely as a radio, you'll only be grasping half the truth. Thought is as often pictorial or purely emblematic as verbal. And anyway, in order to communicate with and understand my colleagues in the Midnight Children's Conference, it was necessary for me quickly to advance beyond the verbal stage. Arriving in their infinitely various minds, I was obliged to get beneath the surface veneer of front-of-mind thoughts in incomprehensible tongues, with the obvious and previously demonstrated effect that they became aware of my presence. Remembering the dramatic effect such an awareness had had on Evie Burns, I went to some pains to alleviate the shock of my entry. In all cases, my standard first transmission was an image of my face, smiling in what I trusted was a soothing, friendly, confident, and leader-like fashion, and of a hand stretched out in friendship. There were, however, teething troubles. It took me a little while to realize that my picture of myself was heavily distorted by my own self-consciousness about my appearance, so that the portrait I sent across the thought waves of the nation, grinning like a Cheshire cat, was about as hideous as a portrait could be, featuring a wondrously enlarged nose, a completely non-existent chin, and giant stains on each temple. It's no wonder that I was often greeted by yelps of mental alarm. I, too, was often similarly frightened by the self-images of my 10-year-old fellows. When we discovered what was happening, I encouraged the membership of the conference one by one to go and look into a mirror, or a patch of still water, and then we did manage to find out what we really looked like. The only problems were that our Carolyn member, who could, you remember, travel through mirrors, accidentally ended up emerging through a restaurant mirror in the smarter part of New Delhi and had to make a hurried retreat, while the blue-eyed member for Kashmir fell into a lake and accidentally changed sex, entering as a girl and emerging as a beautiful boy. When I first introduced myself to Shiva, I saw in his mind the terrifying image of a short, rat-faced youth with filed-down teeth and two of the biggest knees the world has ever seen. Faced with a picture of such grotesque proportions, I allowed the smile on my own beaming image to wither a little. My outstretched hand began to falter and twitch, and Shiva, feeling my presence, reacted at first with utter rage. Great boiling waves of anger scalded the inside of my head. But then, "Hey, look, I know you. You're the rich kid from Methil's estate, isn't it?" And I, equally astonished, "Winky's son, the one who blinded Icelice." His self-image puffed up with pride. "Yeah, yeah, that's me. Nobody messes with me, man." Recognition reduced me into banalities. "So, how's your father, anyway? He doesn't come round." And he, with what felt very like relief, "Him? Man, my father's dead." A momentary pause, then puzzlement. No anger now, and Shiva, "Listen, yeah, this is damn good. How are you doing it?" I launched into my standard explanation, but after a few instants he interrupted. "So, listen, my father said I got born at exactly midnight also. So don't you see? That makes us joint bosses of this gang of yours. Midnight is best, agreed?" "So those other kids gotta do like we tell them." There rose before my eyes the image of a second and more potent Evelyn Lilith Burns. Dismissing this unkind notion, I explained, "That wasn't exactly my idea for the conference. I had in mind something more like a, you know, sort of loose federation of equals, all points of view given free expression." Something resembling a violent snort echoed around the walls of my head. "That, man, that's only rubbish. What are we ever going to do with a gang like that? Gang's gotta have gang bosses. You take me." The puff of pride again. "I've been running a gang up here in Matunga for 2 years now, since I was 8, older kids and all. What do you think of that?" And I, without meaning to, "What's it do, your gang? Does it have rules and all?" Shiva laughed in my ears. "Little rich boy, one rule. Everybody does what I say, or I squeeze the shit out of them with my knees." Desperately, I continued to try and win Shiva around to my point of view. "The thing is, we must be here for a purpose, don't you think? I mean, there has to be a reason. You must agree. So what I thought, we should try and work out what it is, and then, you know, sort of dedicate our lives to..." "Rich kid," Shiva yelled, "you don't know one damn thing." "What purpose, man? What thing in the whole sister sleeping world got reason, yeah? For what reason you're rich and I'm poor? Where's the reason in starving, man? God knows how many millions of damn fools living in this country, man, and you think there's a purpose? Man, I'll tell you, you got to get what you can, do what you can with it, and then you got to die. That's reason, rich boy. Everything else is only mother sleeping wind." And now I, in my midnight bed begin to shake. "But history," I say, "and the Prime Minister wrote me a letter, and don't you even believe in... who knows what we might..." He, my alter ego Shiva, butted in. "Listen, little boy, you're so full of crazy stuff, I can see I'm going to have to take this thing over. You tell that to all these other free kids." Nose and knees and knees and nose. The rivalry that began that night would never be ended until two knives slashed down, down, down. Whether the spirits of Mian Abdullah, whom knives killed years before, had leaked into me, imbuing me with the notion of loose federalism and making me vulnerable to knives, I cannot say. But at that point, I found a measure of courage and told Shiva, "You can't run the conference without me. They won't even be able to listen to you." And he, confirming the declaration of war, "Rich kid, they'll want to know about me. You just try and stop me." "Yes," I told him, "I'll try." Shiva, the god of destruction, who is also most potent of deities, Shiva, greatest of dancers, who rides on a bull, whom no force can resist. The boy Shiva, he told us, had to fight for survival from his earliest days. And when his father had, about a year previously, completely lost his singing voice, Shiva had had to defend himself against Wee Willy Winky's parental zeal. "He blindfolded me, man. He wrapped a rag around my eyes and took me to the roof of the Chawl Man. You know what was in his hand? A sister sleeping hammer, man. A hammer! Bastard was going to smash my legs up, man. It happens, you know, rich boy. They do it to kids so they can always earn money begging. You get more if you're all broken up, man. So I'm pushed over till I'm lying down on the roof, man, and then..." And then hammer swinging down towards knees larger and knobblier than any policeman's, an easy target. But now the knees went into action. Faster than lightning, the knees parted, felt the breath of the down-rushing hammer and spread wide apart. And then hammer plunging between knees, still held in his father's hand, and then the knees rushing together like fists, the hammer clattering harmlessly on concrete. The wrist of Wee Willy Winky clamped between the knees of his blindfolded son, hoarse breath escaping from the lips of the anguished father, and still the knees closing in, tighter and tighter until there is a snap. Broke his goddamn wrist, man. That showed him damn fine, no? I swear. Shiva and I were born under Capricorn Rising. The constellation left me alone, but it gave Shiva its gift. Capricorn, as any astrologer will tell you, is the heavenly body with power over the knees. On Election Day 1957, the All India Congress was badly shocked. Although it won the election, 12 million votes made the Communists the largest single opposition party, and in Bombay, despite the efforts of Boss Patil, large numbers of electors failed to place their crosses against the Congress symbol of sacred cow and suckling calf, preferring the less emotive pictograms of Samyukta Maharashtra Samiti and Maha Gujarat Parishad. When the communist peril was discussed on our hillock, my mother continued to blush, and we resigned ourselves to the partition of the state of Bombay. One member of the Midnight Children's Conference played a minor role in the elections. Winky's supposed son Shiva was recruited by, well, perhaps I will not name the party, but only one party had really large sums to spend, and on polling day, he and his gang, who call themselves cowboys, were to be seen standing outside a polling station in the north of the city, some holding long stout sticks, others juggling with stones, still others picking their teeth with knives, all of them encouraging the electorate to use its vote with wisdom and care. And after the polls closed, were seals broken on ballot boxes? Did ballot stuffing occur? At any rate, when the votes were counted, it was discovered that Kasim the Red had narrowly failed to win the seat, and my rival's paymasters were well pleased. "But now," Padma says mildly, "what date was it?" And without thinking, I answer, "Sometime in the spring." And then it occurs to me that I have made another error, that the election of 1957 took place before, not after, my 10th birthday. But although I have racked my brains, my memory refuses stubbornly to alter the sequence of events. This is worrying. I don't know what's gone wrong. She says, trying uselessly to console me, What are you so long for in your face? Everybody forgets some small things all the time. But if small things go, will large things be close behind? Alpha and Omega. There was turmoil in Bombay in the months after the election. There is turmoil in my thoughts as I recall those days. My error has upset me badly, so now to regain my equilibrium, I shall place myself firmly on the familiar ground of Methil's estate, leaving the history of the Midnight Children's Conference to one side and the pain of the Pioneer Cafe to another. I shall tell you about the fall of Evie Burns. I have titled this episode somewhat oddly. Alpha and Omega stares back at me from the page, demanding to be explained. A curious heading for what will be my story's halfway point, one that reeks of beginnings and ends, when you could say it should be more concerned with middles. But unrepentantly, I have no intention of changing it, although there are many alternative titles, for instance, From Monkey to Rhesus, or Finger Redux, or, in a more elusive style, The Gander, a reference, obviously, to the mythical bird, the Hamsa, or Parahamsa symbol of the ability to live in two worlds, the physical and the spiritual, the world of land and water, and the world of air of flight. But Alpha and Omega it is. Alpha and Omega it remains, because there are beginnings here, and all manner of ends. But you'll soon see what I mean. Padma clicks her tongue in exasperation. You're talking funny again, she criticizes. Are you going to tell about Evie or not? After the general election, the central government continued to shilly-shally about the future of Bombay. The state was to be partitioned, then not to be partitioned, then partitioned reared its head again. And as for the city itself, it was to be the capital of Maharashtra, or of both Maharashtra and Gujarat, or an independent state of its own. While the government tried to work out what on earth to do, the city's inhabitants decided to encourage it to be quick. Riots proliferated, and you could still hear the old battle song of the Marathas. How are you? I am well. I'll take a stick and thrash you to hell, rising above the fray. And to make things worse, the weather joined in the melee. There was a severe drought, roads cracked. In the villages, peasants were being forced to kill their cows, and on Christmas Day, of whose significance no boy who attended a mission school and was attended upon by a Catholic ayah could fail to be aware, there was a series of loud explosions at the Valkeshwar Reservoir, and the main freshwater pipes, which were the city's lifelines, began to blow fountains into the air like giant steel whales. The newspapers were full of talk of saboteurs. Speculation over the criminals' identities and political affiliation jostled for space against reports of the continuing wave of whore murders. I was particularly interested to learn that the murderer had his own curious signature. The corpses of the ladies of the night were all strangled to death. There were bruises on their necks. Bruises too large to be thumbprints, but wholly consistent with the marks which would be left by a pair of giant, preternaturally powerful knees. But I digress. What, Padma's frown demands, does all this have to do with Evelyn Lilith Burns? Instantly leaping to attention, as it were, I provide the answer. In the days after the destruction of the city's fresh water supply, the stray cats of Bombay began to congregate in those areas of the city where water was still relatively plentiful. That is to say, the better-off areas, in which each house owned its own overhead or underground water tank. And, as a result, the two-story hillock of Methil's estate was invaded by an army of thirsting felines. Cats swarming all over the circus ring, cats climbing bougainvillea creepers and leaping into sitting rooms, cats knocking over flower vases to drink the plant's stale water, cats bivouacked in bathrooms, slurping liquid out of water closets, cats rampant in the kitchens of the palaces of William Methold. The estate servants were vanquished in their attempts to repel the great cat invasion. The ladies of the estate were reduced to helpless exclamations of horror. Hard, dry worms of cat excrement were everywhere, Gardens were ruined by sheer feline force of numbers, and at night sleep became an impossibility as the army found voice and sang its thirst at the moon. The Baroness Simke von der Heyden refused to fight the cats. She was already showing the signs of the disease which would shortly lead to her extermination. Nussi Ibrahim rang my mother to announce, "Amina, sister, it is the end of the world." She was wrong, because on the third day after the great cat invasion, Evelyn Lilith Burns visited each estate household in turn, carrying her daisy air gun casually in one hand, and offered, in return for bounty money, to end the plague of pussies double quick. All that day, Methil's estate echoed with the sounds of Evie's air gun and the agonized walls of the cats, as Evie stalked the entire army one by one and made herself rich. But, as history so often demonstrates, the moment of one's greatest triumph also contains the seeds of one's final downfall. And so it proved, because Evie's persecution of the cats was, as far as the brass monkey was concerned, absolutely the last straw. "Brother," the monkey told me grimly, "I told you I'd get that girl. Now, right now, the time has come." Unanswerable questions. Was it true that my sister had acquired the languages of cats as well as birds? Was it her fondness for feline life which pushed her over the brink? By the time of the great cat invasion, the monkey's hair had faded into brown. She had broken a habit of burning shoes, but still, and for whatever reason, there was a fierceness in her which none of the rest of us ever possessed. And she went down into the circus ring and yelled at the top of her voice, "Evie! Evie Burns! You come out here this minute, wherever you are!" Surrounded by fleeing cats, the monkey awaited Evelyn Burns. I went out onto the first floor veranda to watch. From their verandas, Sunny and Ice Slice and Hair Oil and Cyrus were watching too. We saw Evie Burns appear from the direction of the Versailles Villa kitchens. She was blowing the smoke away from the barrel of her gun. "You Indians can thank your lucky stars you got me around," Evie declared, "or you'd just have got eaten by these cats." We saw Evie fall silent as she saw the things sitting tensely in the monkey's eyes, and then, like a blur, the monkey descended on Evie, and a battle began which lasted for what seemed like several hours, but it can only have been a few minutes. Shrouded in the dust of the circus ring, they rolled, kicked, scratched, bit. Small tufts of hair flew out of the dust cloud, and there were elbows and feet in dirtied white socks, and knees and fragments of frock flying out of the cloud. Grown-ups came running, servants couldn't pull them apart, and in the end, Homie Catrack's gardener turned his hose on them to separate them. The brass monkey stood up a little crookedly and shook the sodden hem of her dress, ignoring the cries of retribution proceeding from the lips of Amina Senai and Mary Pereira, because there, in the hose-wet dirt of the circus ring, lay Evie Burns, her tooth braces broken, her hair matted with dust and spittle, her spirit and her dominion over us broken once and for all. A few weeks later, her father sent her home for good. "To get a decent education away from these savages," he was heard to remark. I only heard from her once, 6 months later, when, right out of the blue, she wrote me the letter which informed me that she had knifed an old lady who had objected to her assault on a cat. "I gave it to her all right," Evie wrote. "Tell your sister she just got lucky." I salute that unknown old woman. She paid the monkey's bill. More interesting than Evie's last message is a thought which occurs to me now. As I look back down the tunnel of time, holding before my eyes the image of Monkey and Evie rolling in the dirt, I seem to discern the driving force behind their battle to the death, a motive far deeper than the mere persecution of cats. They were fighting over me. Evie and my sister, who were in many ways not at all dissimilar, kicked and scratched, ostensibly over the fate of a few thirsty strays. But perhaps Evie's kicks were aimed at me. Perhaps they were the violence of her anger at my invasion of her head. And then, maybe, the strength of the monkey was the strength of sibling loyalty, and her act of war was actually an act of love. Blood, then, was spilled in the circus ring. Another rejected title for these pages, you may as well know, was Thicker Than Water. In those days of water shortages, something thicker than water ran down the face of Evie Burns. The loyalties of blood motivated the brass monkey, and in the streets of the city, rioters spilled each other's blood. There were bloody murders, and perhaps it is not appropriate to end this sanguinary catalogue by mentioning, once again, the rushes of blood to my mother's cheeks. 12 million votes were coloured red that year, and red is the colour of blood. More blood will flow soon. The types of blood, A and O, Alpha and Omega. And another, a third possibility, must be kept in mind. Also other factors, zygosity and Kell antibodies, and that most mysterious of sanguinary attributes, known as rhesus, which is also a type of monkey. Everything has shape if you look for it. There is no escape from form. But before blood has its day, I shall take wing, like the Parahamsagander, who can soar out of one element into another and return, briefly, to the affairs of my inner world. Because, although the fall of Evie Burns ended my ostracism by the Hilltop Children, still I found it difficult to forgive. And for a time, holding myself solitary and aloof, I immersed myself in the events inside my head, in the early history of the Association of the Midnight Children. To be honest, I didn't like Shiva. I disliked the roughness of his tongue, the crudity of his ideas, and I was beginning to suspect him of a string of terrible crimes, although I found it impossible to find any evidence in his thoughts, because he, alone of the Children of Midnight, could close off from me any part of his thoughts he chose to keep to himself, which, in itself, increased my growing dislike and suspicion of the rat-faced fellow. However, I was nothing if not fair, and it would not have been fair to have kept him apart from the other members of the conference. I should explain that as my mental facility increased, I found that it was possible not only to pick up the children's transmissions, not only to broadcast my own messages, but also, since I seemed to be stuck with this radio metaphor, to act as a sort of national network, so that by opening my transformed mind to all the children, I could turn it into a kind of forum in which they could talk to one another through me. So, in the early days of 1958, the 581 children would assemble for 1 hour between midnight and 1 a.m. in the Lok Sabha or Parliament of my brain. We were as motley, as raucous, as undisciplined as any bunch of 581 10-year-olds. And on top of our natural exuberance, there was the excitement of our discovery of each other. After 1 hour of top-volume yelling, jabbering, arguing, giggling, I would fall exhausted into a sleep too deep for nightmares, and still wake up with a headache. But I didn't mind. Awake, I was obliged to face the multiple miseries of maternal perfidy and paternal decline, of the fickleness of friendship and the varied tyrannies of school. Asleep, I was at the centre of the most exciting world any child had ever discovered. Despite Shiva, it was nicer to be asleep. Shiva's conviction that he and I, was the natural leader of our group by dint of his and my birth on the stroke of midnight had, I was bound to admit, one strong argument in its favour. It seemed to me then, it seems to me now, that the midnight miracle had indeed been remarkably hierarchical in nature, that the children's abilities declined dramatically on the basis of the distance of their time of birth from midnight. But even this was a point of view which was hotly contested. "What do you mean? How can you say that?" they chorused, the boy from the Gur Forest, whose face was absolutely blank and featureless, except for eyes, nose holes, space for mouth, and could take on any features he chose. And Harilal, who could run at the speed of the wind, and God knows how many others. "Who says it's better to do one thing or another? And can you fly? I can fly. And yeah, and me. Can you turn one fish into 50? And today I went to visit tomorrow. You can do that? Well then." In the face of such a storm of protest, even Shiva changed his tune. But he was to find a new one, which would be much more dangerous, dangerous for the children and for me, because I had found that I was not immune to the lure of leadership. Who found the children anyway? Who formed the conference? Who gave them their meeting place? Was I not the joint eldest? And should I not receive the respect and obeisances merited by my seniority? And didn't the one who provided the clubhouse run the club? To which Shiva, forget all that, man. That club-shub stuff is only for you rich boys. But, for a time, he was overruled. Parvati the witch, a conjurer's daughter from Delhi, took my part, just as years later she would save my life, and announced, No, listen now, everybody. Without Salim we are nowhere. We can't talk or anything. He is right. Let him be the chief. And I... No, never mind, chief. Just think of me as a big brother, maybe. Yes, we're a family of a kind. I'm just the oldest me. To which Shiva replied scornful, but unable to argue, Okay, big brother. So now, tell us what we do. At this point, I introduced the conference to the notions which plagued me all this time, the notions of purpose and meaning. We must think, I said, what we are for. I record faithfully the views of a typical selection of the conference members, excepting the circus freaks and the ones who, like Sundari the beggar girl with the knife scars, had lost their powers and tended to remain silent in our debates, like poor relations at a feast. Among the philosophies and aims suggested were collectivism. We should all get together and live somewhere, no? What would we need from anyone else? And individualism. You say we, but we together are unimportant. What matters is that each of us has a gift to use for his or her own good. Filial duty. However we can help our father, mother, that is what it is for us to do. And infant revolution. Now, at last, we must show all kids that it is possible to get rid of parents. Capitalism. Just think what businesses we could do. How rich, Allah, we could be. And altruism. Our country needs gifted people. We must ask the government how it wishes to use our skills. Science. We must allow ourselves to be studied. And religion. Let us declare ourselves to the world so that all may glory in God. Courage. We should invade Pakistan. And cowardice. Oh, heavens, we must stay secret. Just think what they will do to us. Stone us for witches or what all. There were declarations of women's rights and pleas for the improvement of the lot of untouchables. Landless children dreamed of land, and tribals from the hills of jeeps. And there were also fantasies of power. They can't stop us, man. We can bewitch and fly and read minds and turn them into frogs and make gold and fishes, and they will fall in love with us, and we can vanish through mirrors and change our sex. How will they be able to fight? I won't deny I was disappointed. I shouldn't have been. There was nothing unusual about the children, except for their gifts. Their heads were full of all the usual things. Fathers, mothers, money, food, land, possessions, fame, power, God. Nowhere in the thoughts of the conference could I find anything as new as ourselves. But then I was on the wrong track too. I could not see any more clearly than anyone else. And even when Sumitra, the time traveller, said, I'm telling you, all this is pointless. They'll finish us before we start. We all ignored him, with the optimism of youth, which is a more virulent form of the same disease that once infected my grandfather, Adam Aziz. We refused to look on the dark side, and not a single one of us suggested that the purpose of Midnight's children might be annihilation, that we would have no meaning until we were destroyed. For the sake of their privacy, I am refusing to distinguish the voices from one another, and for other reasons. For one thing, my narrative could not cope with 581 fully rounded personalities. For another, the children, despite their wondrously discreet and varied gifts, remained, to my mind, a sort of many-headed monster